You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Don, I think we went from summer to fall to summer again, because it was 80 degrees.
It is going to be 80 degrees today. It is October 29, as we record this show for broadcast on October 30, 2025. 57 degrees as we speak. It did get down to 44 degrees yesterday morning, just so you all know. And we're going up to a high today of 80, sunny, gorgeous, possible north wind over the next day or so. This did come in on a little bit of a north wind yesterday. Tonight will be 50 and mostly clear. Thursday will be mostly sunny, 74 degrees. Thursday night will be 49, partly cloudy. Friday will be 75 degrees, mostly sunny. Friday night, 50 degrees, mostly clear. Saturday, 75 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, 51, mostly clear. Sunday, 76 degrees and sunny. Sunday night will be 52. Monday, mostly sunny, 73. Monday night, 53, partly cloudy. Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 70. So temperatures in the 70s to around 80 for this week. And no rain on the immediate horizon. There's been some... They're watching a storm that's out there, just like the last one. It appears to be going north, which, by the way, this is not a strong La Nina event that we're in at this point, but that is the pattern with La Nina episodes here in Northern California, is the storms come our way and then travel north instead of going over us. And the last storm that came over that atmospheric river, they got a couple inches of rain up in Eureka, and Southern Oregon got rain, and we barely got a few sprinkles down here. And that is the La Nina pattern. Southern Oregon gets the rain that's aiming at us. And that seems to be what's happening mid next week. According to the National Weather Service, ensemble guidance, merging the models to see what they come out with, and cluster analysis, looking more closely at them, are suggesting that the potential for a weather system to approach the Pacific Northwest as upper-level troughing develops offshore. Okay, we see that. I look on the radar, Ventusky, places like that. There it is. What's it going to do? Confidence is low, says the National Weather Service. I'm sorry you're not feeling confident. But right now, it appears that the best chances are for just some beneficial showers to the area Tuesday into Wednesday of next week. The Climate Prediction Center 8 to 14-day outlook favors above-normal temperatures and near to above normal precipitation for the November 4th through 10th time frame. And they follow up with, always remember to check your local weather forecast at weather.gov for updates. So sunny and warm, great planting weather. I've been out planting trees. The soil is absolutely perfect right now. An inch and a half of rain a week or so ago, it softened up very nicely. Still dry about 18 inches down on my property, so you might experience the same thing when you go to plant a bigger tree. Still dry down further, so you might want to soak the spot a little bit before you start. But check it out. You'll be surprised how pleasantly workable the soil is right now and all those amazing things that you can plant. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. That means we rely on folks like you to send in contributions to keep us on the air. If you like what you hear, if you like all the great programming here at KDRT, go to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And we've got a couple of those public service announcements that public radio stations like to do. Lois, go ahead.
Well, the first one I have is Patricia Carpenter's Seasonal Ramble. And if you go to the California Native Plant Society website, which is cnps.org, Right there, you can go, you can sign up for, you can register for going to this event. And then they'll give you instructions on how to get there and everything. And basically, what it is, Patricia's Native Garden is open to the public. Drop in anytime between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m., rain or shine. And it is a self-guided garden tour, and maps are available on site. That's Sunday, November 2nd. Don, you're going to be doing Sunday too. So if they go there in the morning, can they come and see you?
Absolutely. Sunday is our fifth annual legacy celebration for Tree Davis. I'll be the master of ceremonies, which means I stand up there and keep people moving. And we'll be honoring our stewardship awardees this year, as we always do. We like to highlight individuals and groups in the community that have made a big difference for what we call our urban forest, or what I like to call our community forest, the trees that keep us all shaded and cool. November 2nd, as Lois noted, it's from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Tree Davis Memorial Grove, which is right south of University Retirement Center on Shasta Drive. You'll see us out front there, a big canopy and a bunch of people. It's 2 to 4 p.m. If you happen to use a automobile to get there, you'll need to pull around onto the residential side behind the park in order to park your vehicle. If you bring a bike or walk or whatever, there's places for you to stow those as you listen to us speak and join us in celebrating trees at the annual legacy celebration. A little foreshadowing here. One of our stewardship award recipients is Davis Garden Show's own Gaina, who has made a big difference on the little parcel down in South Davis, planting native plants and some native trees. We've got some other award recipients that I would love to mention, but tell you what, just come to the event and you'll have fun. Lots of tree people. We always do this in the fall. We're always really nervous about the weather when we schedule it. First one, it was raining and 45 degrees, and 50 people came out and had a great time. This year it's going to be sunny, perhaps a little breezy. The trees have fall color. Great day to just stop by. If you RSVP, we'll make sure to have enough cookies and coffee for you. But if you don't, just show up anyway. That's Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m., Tree Davis Annual Legacy Celebration on Shasta Drive, just south of the University Retirement Center.
So, we have lots of listeners out there, and the only way we know about them is if they send us a question or a brag or something like that. But when we had our KDRT's 21st birthday party, which was over at Sudworks last week, and someone dropped off a note to them and they passed it on to us. And it says, Don and Lois, thank you for your wonderful podcast. I've learned so much from you. My plants are less dead and so much happier now.
Less dead.
Signed, Tommy.
Thank you,
So
Tommy.
thank you.
Glad to have your plants less dead. And Kevin from Yuba City came by the nursery and said hi. So hi, Kevin. Glad to see you. Always happy to chat with our listeners when they stop by the Redwood Barn there in Davis. People come to Davis for a lot of reasons, or just passing through. Always fun to meet you folks in person. So hi, Kevin. Thanks for stopping by.
All right, well, let's go on. Oh, this was a walk-in question. Someone walked into Don's store holding a short piece of his lemon tree
Yeah.
and said, this lemon tree is getting yellow. The tangerine tree looks fine.
This was a funny one. First of all, I remember we said at the start, we got into the 40s. We've gotten into the 40s at night twice, and we're already getting the why are my citrus leaves turning yellow questions. So it is
Because
temperature
you got into
related.
the 40s
If we got
twice.
into the 40s, right. And here's the thing, the first to show the yellowing will be the lemons. Those are just for whatever reason. They're always lighter green to begin with, and they just show that yellowing. They're a little more cold tender in the first place, but this isn't a cold injury issue. This is just a cold change issue. We get into the 40s, the lemons, Meyer lemon, but especially the true lemons, Eureka, Lisbon, that type, will start to yellow. It's not harmful, but it's something to be aware of. And it is almost November 1, and by far the most common question we'll answer through middle of March, when the night temperatures finally get back up to around 50 again, is why is my citrus yellow? And they want to know, do I need to feed it? Don't need to, but might green it up a bit. Is there something wrong? No, temperature is low. It's nothing to be concerned about typically. That's usually the problem. But this was an interesting second stage to the question.
It turns out that tangerine tree and the lemon tree, they're the same tree.
Yeah, so that's not a lemon. what he has is rootstock. It is a lemon, but it's not, it wasn't planted as a lemon. Let's put it that way. One of the common rootstocks, especially years ago, but it's still used by some growers, is a rootstock called the rough lemon rootstock. I have it on my navel orange, north side of that tree. Ever since the big freeze of 1990, when I had to cut the thing back to a stump, it resprouted. Most of it was my navel orange, but on the north side, which was badly injured at 16 degrees, no big surprise there. Rootstock has been growing ever since. Let's see, this is 2025, and that was 1990. So yeah, I've been dealing with this for a while. And it's very vigorous and it's thorny, and it tends to outgrow the top. And it's a lighter yellow to begin with. And then we get into the winter and it's distinctly lighter yellow. So that makes it easier to see where the rootstock is. It's not a real good lemon. It is a lemon. You can use it. If your recipe calls for lemon juice, this is lemon juice. It is a true lemon in that regard. But it's not got a rich flavor or the aromatics that we associate with true lemons like Eureka, Lisbon, some of the heirloom Italian lemons, nor does it have the richness of flavor of something like a Meyer lemon, which is a lemon Mandarin cross. It's just lemon juice and it's okay. But that means that he's got a big chunk of his tree that's rootstock. This rootstock will outgrow the tangerine or mandarin without question. It's generally much more vigorous than whatever has been grafted onto it. So it is important when branches come up on most citrus from below the graft, well, all citrus from below the graft union, if they are grafted, which most are, to remove that, or pretty quickly you'll have just a rough lemon or a citrange rootstock, and neither of them are particularly desirable. At least in the case of the rough lemon, you can use it. The juice is still sort of a lemon juice. In the case of the other one, far more widely used nowadays, the citrange rootstock or sour orange rootstock, it's not just sour, it's also bitter. So while it has a distinctive flavor, and some people actually do use it for marmalade, because you use so much sugar that the bitterness is masked. Most people don't have much use for the citrange rootstock fruit. In both cases, it's a different plant, just like most fruit trees, it's a different plant. So if you let it go, pretty soon that's what you're likely to have. One of my neighbors around the corner has a big tree, probably 60, 70 years old. It appears to be a mandarin of some sort or a small fruited orange. And one whole side of it right now is already turning yellow compared to the rest of the tree. So it's kind of color coded is what needs to come out. I can tell you though, it's not a fun job because this rootstock is thorny and the thorns are formidable and they have an irritant in them. So as you're doing this, wear long sleeves, heavy gloves, protect your eyes because you can really injure yourself and take that rootstock out of there, or else you're going to have eventually a tree that's predominantly rootstock and only a little of what you intentionally planted will be left. Right now, easy to tell. They're color coded. They're turning yellow on the side that you don't want.
All right. So this one, again, a walk-in one. I want a red leaf plum, but I don't want any fruit. I have the old-fashioned one that's been in our house forever, but it makes plums all over the ground.
Oh, yes.
So Don, what's a red leaf plum? Isn't that just a plum with red leaves?
Yes. Prunus sericifera is the species and genus of, red leaf plum, and it's a European plum. And a long time ago, a variety with brilliant burgundy red leaves came along, probably just spontaneously, and became very popular. And in the 1950s and 60s, this tree was planted everywhere in California. That was a period of rapid suburban expansion in California, and the suburbs that were being built were tighter lot sizes than older suburbs. So we needed some, we, they, the developers needed small trees that were pretty. Developers will typically in those days put in one decorative tree in front of a house, not usually big shade trees, unfortunately, but they would put in one decorative tree. And they're very, very, very pretty trees with that burgundy, almost purple red leaf color. Sometimes they're called purple leaf plums. Prunus sericifera, Atropurpurea. The first one that really became popular was one called Thundercloud, which had a strongly V-like form, a growth habit at first, and then spread out to be a pretty good sized tree, 20 to 30 foot tree with about a 15 to 20 foot spread usually. And then a new one called Newport and so forth. The problem with these was, aside from the beautiful flowers in the spring and the lovely burgundy red leaf color, they set large, large crops of plums. Perfectly edible, but a little bit astringent. This isn't a plum you would grow for that purpose. But I remember, as a teenager reading Sunset Magazine, which at that time was the leading horticultural publication in the West. giving people pointers for how to make jam, jelly, or wine from the readily plum fruit because it was such a massive amount of production. Then along came various sprays that you could use. Forel is an example where you could try and spray the tree when it was in bloom to block the fruit production, and it would reduce fruit production anywhere from 25 to 50%. So instead of 1,000 fruit, you now had, 500 on the ground. Didn't make that much difference, but it helped to some degree. And this stained concrete and got tracked in. I mean, they became a major nuisance. Along came a variety, Crater Vesuvius, K-R-A-U-T-E-R, Vesuvius, which has light crops and often none, which tells me that it's probably not self-fruitful. Therefore, it's not self-pollinating. The others definitely were. So if you don't have another red leaf plum of any kind nearby, you probably won't get fruit or you won't get much. Sometimes trees that are not self-fruitful are only partially not self-fruitful. Sometimes they do fruit, just as with olives. But if you did have other plums, red leaf plums, or certain types of European plums nearby, you would get some fruit production. So Crater Vesuvius, by the 1970s, was the most widely planted red leaf plum. And it's not a major nuisance. Most people who have Crater Vesuvius can live with it. If it's in a lawn, particularly, the fruit just kind of disintegrates into the lawn. But it's not fruitless. Every now and then, more than you might think, I'll encounter a customer who wants zero fruit. We get this with olives. I don't want a single fruit. I have two beautiful olive trees on my property because the purchaser dug them back up and brought them back to me when they said a tiny amount of fruit because they couldn't have it. All right, fine. So there are some that are truly fruitless. And in the case of plums, Purple Pony is a variety that's been on the market since 1962 and has never fruited. So that's a pretty good run. We've never seen fruit on this. And so we can safely declare that it's probably self-sterile and also not possible to pollinate it. So it does not fruit. It's also kind of dwarf. Grows slowly, it fits in a patio really nicely, relatively upright growth habit. So it's kind of a good one for a side yard or a courtyard where you want that real burgundy red color of the leaf. Really pretty flowers early in the spring. It is a truly fruitless, small red leaf plum, Purple Pony. Right? There's another one though that I steer people towards. It's not a red leaf plum, but it does start out with red leaves. And then they age to sort of a burgundy tinged green. It's called the flowering plum, Prunus bleriana, B-L-I-R-E-I-A-N-A. It's a hybrid, an interspecific hybrid of two different species of Prunus, of plums. Interspecific hybrids are often completely sterile. And this one is. We've never seen fruit on Prunus bleriana. And it isn't red leaf through the summer, but it's really pretty red leaves in the spring. And they're a dark reddish green in the summertime and a relatively upright tree with a nice growth habit that fits in a lot of yards. It would get to 20 to 25 feet. With age, a lot of these plums will start to spread out somewhat. If you want more spread, you can encourage that by taking out the center of the tree when it's young, as you might do with a fruit tree, then carefully choosing some branches for spread. You can govern the shape and height of the tree, but that one is fruitless and it flowers with the almonds. Well, people locally are going, wow, really? Because that's February. Late February into early March, Prunus bleriana is in bloom. All the other plums are late March. So this is well ahead of the other trees. It is, in fact, one of the first trees that blooms around the area, and there's lots of them planted locally. So that light pink tree with a double flower, lots of petals that you see when the almonds are blooming in late February into early March is Prunus bleriana. And it is a very well-mannered tree, does not fruit and gives you the red leaves in the spring and has that really lovely early bloom. Really attractive to pollinators, particularly the European honeybees, because the big growers, have dropped their bee boxes by the almonds before the almonds come into bloom. This starts to bloom right with the almonds. And so the bees are out like crazy finding flowers anywhere they can. And they're all over the Prunus bleriana, which many people consider an advantage. And a few people who don't like bees might consider that a drawback. So be aware of that. The Prunus bleriana, very early bloom, lovely leaf color, well-mannered tree. None of the flowering plums, either this kind or the red leaf plum, are particularly drought tolerant. These are not trees that say Tree Davis or the City of Davis or someone's going to plant as a shade tree. They don't get big enough. They're not going to plant them in places where irrigation is not guaranteed. So it's not a shade tree list type of tree. I've taken to calling these garden trees, flowering cherries, flowering plums, crab apples, things like that. These are not low water trees necessarily. They won't fit in every situation, but they're lovely in a garden and they can be a real focal point in the garden. When the red leaf plum was in its heyday, If you went over to Napa Valley, we drive over there all the time into wine country. They planted all the vineyards over there, planted these red leaf plums at the ends of the rows of grapes, and it was quite spectacular. I think that's the only reason they did it, honestly. I don't think there was any horticultural or ecological purpose to them, but they just liked the way they look. It might have drawn some beneficials in, I don't know. They don't need pollinators for grapes, they're wind pollinated, so that wasn't a factor. But they were lovely. You drive through there in the spring, and also as they were coming out in leaf and later in the spring and into the summer, and the red leaf plums were quite attractive. That was in the 1970s. They're mostly gone. So that's the other thing. There's a lifespan. These are 30, 40-year trees. So they're not something that's going to be there 50 to 100 years from now. Most of them have been replaced in Napa Valley with olives because there's money in those. But the red leaf plums were very pretty in their time. If you're looking for a fruitless red leaf plum, dwarf purple pony, or the flowering plum, Prunus bleriana. If you want the old-fashioned kind, Crowder Vesuvius has the least fruit of what you might call the true red leaf plums that get to the 15 to 25-foot range.
They have red leaves in the spring. Do they have fall color?
It's yellow. It's kind of pretty. They're not among the trees that are spectacular for it, but they join the deciduous trees in the fall festival, yes.
Okay. So
That brings us to another garden tree, Patrick.
you mentioned when you were talking, you mentioned crab apples.
Yeah.
And so we've got a message from Emily who says, "Hi, Don and Lois. I live on the coast in zone 17 and only get 150 or so chill hours. I want to plant crab apple trees with white blossoms for ornamental reasons. I also want the benefit of pollination for my other apple trees. I've been looking at varieties with berry-sized fruit like Everest and Golden Raindrops, but I haven't found much information about chill hours. Any recommendations for reliably low chill crab apples?"
That's a very challenging topic, interestingly.
When we were setting up, he spent at least 15 to 20 minutes on his computer looking at various websites trying to find
Well,
something.
actually, I want to narrow it down, looking particularly at Frank Schmidt and Son Company website, because they have introduced most of the crab apples, or at least they carry most of the crab apples that are on the market. J. Frank Schmidt and Son, Schmidt and Son, up in Oregon, Boring, Oregon. I've been to Boring, Oregon. It's not that boring. It's very pretty. And they have lots and lots of crab apples, and they don't mention the chilling hours on any of them. It's a very interesting fact. Most people grow crab apples for the bloom and just as ornamental trees. There is one transcendent that is grown specifically for the fruit. I have that one. It tastes delicious. It's for use in preserves, things like that. We don't typically eat them right off the tree, but they're used for jams and jellies and that sort of thing. And some of them, this is the important part and part of the question here, are actually good pollinizers for other apple varieties, for what we would call regular domestic apples. So in apple country, there's huge charts of cross-pollination requirements of apple trees. And frequently people will just plant one of the local or regional specialty crab apples to sort of assure pollination. And they will do that in many cases. Whether that'll work in zone 17, I'm not absolutely sure. And chilling hours could be a real question mark on this. I'm looking at like 8 pages of crab apples, and there's only a handful that are really common in the trade. But one thing I will say though, chilling hours are complicated. We've gone from a chilling hours model to a chilling portions model. I've had long conversations with a guy who worked at Dave Wilson Nursery for more than 20 plus years, and he has said to me probably the least accurate chilling hours numbers you're going to find are with respect to apples. They grow apples in a lot of places they shouldn't be able to grow apples because Americans plant apples everywhere we go. All
That's
right,
right.
everywhere we go. And there was an apple industry in the hills above Los Angeles for many years with varieties that shouldn't be growing there. There's Apple Hill outside of San Diego, up in the Julian area, where apples do great. And they don't get the same chilling hours that you'd look expect if you looked up those varieties in textbooks or on charts like this. What they seem to need is to go into and out of dormancy in a particular way. It isn't a specific number of chilling hours. Chilling portions model probably makes more difference than anything. So if you're listening to us in zone 23 or 24, coastal Southern California, where there are spikes of high temperature in January. Now, the Los Angeles, which is a little further up from Zone 24, Zone 23, perhaps, the coastal zones, and even in the interior, they can get 80 degrees in January. It's happened. That will undo a lot of chilling hours that had already accumulated, is the way we look at it. So we call them chilling portions. Anything above 60 degrees is undoing the chilling portions that you were getting earlier in the season. Those are challenging areas to grow apples. If you find a variety that does well, last week I mentioned the Anna apple only needs 200 hours, seemingly, and does well. Then you find one that's a regional favorite. You might find a crab apple that's a regional favorite, except the crab apples are barely grown in California. There's hardly any nurseries that sell them. People don't come into my nursery asking for crab apples. There's maybe two or three varieties that my growers do. I don't know how they chose them or what their basis for it was. So I don't know that you're going to get the information you need that way. But chilling hours are not as hard and fast as people think they are. They seem to be very accurate for stone fruits, plums, apricots, peaches, nectarines, pluots, things like that. If it says 600 chilling hours and you only get 400, pretty good chance the flowers won't develop properly, especially if you're prone to spikes of high temperature in the winter, but even still. But apples, the pome plants, the pears and apples and quince, there are many places where they fruit fine, despite not getting what should be the right number of chilling hours. So I do urge you to experiment a little bit if you have room for it. I think you'll probably find that one of the more popular varieties of crab apple will probably flower adequately. It may overlap and bloom with your regular apple. Many apples that are said to need cross-pollination don't. We have found that also. They don't absolutely need it. That's for orchards. That's for people growing them to make money. If you only get 100 fruit instead of 500, you're probably fine. So you don't absolutely need cross-pollination, just like you see on the charts, except when it says that they're literally self-sterile, like Ravenstein requires a pollinizer, or you won't get fruit. Most others are partially self-fruitful, and that's adequate for most people. And that same goes with European pears, and in my opinion, Asian pears. They'll probably fruit adequately, even if you don't have a pollinizer nearby. So if your main purpose is cross-pollination, I wouldn't worry too much about that. If your main purpose is getting bloom, you'll probably get bloom if it's anywhere close to your chilling hours. You've only got 175, it says 300, 400, you're probably going to get bloom. You'll probably get cross-pollination. If it says 800, probably not. So that's the range I would give you. Look for the lowest available that you can get, and that's probably your best bet. You'll probably get adequate results. I know the Western Garden Book mentions that there are more than 200 named kinds of ornamental crab apples, end quote. New ones appear with each year's new catalogs, end quote. And that is true. There's a lot of different kinds. Probably the most commonly planted is the Japanese flowering crab apple, Malus floribunda. Widely, widely adaptable. That would be one you're likely to find in your area. But the main thing I would look for on the label or in discussion with the people selling it to you is fire blight resistance. Crab apples, like apples and pears, are susceptible to fire blight, which was here in North America waiting for apples when we brought them in from Europe. And it went on to our domestic apples and spread on to crab apples in many cases. Crab apples, as mentioned, are a mix of genetic parentage. Some of them have European and native ancestry, and some of that European ancestry carried a susceptibility to fire blight with it. There are varieties that are very resistant, varieties that are very susceptible, and a lot that are in between. When you're purchasing a pear, you absolutely should ask about this because fire blight can be very devastating to European pears and certain of the Asian pears. It can be a real problem on flowering crab apples and the fruiting ones, presumably, as well. I get it on the transcendent crab apple that I have. I get the trees. It's been pruned pretty severely, 15 by 15. There's probably 20 or 30 points of infection every year. I wait till the summer. I get up on a ladder. I used to do this and just prune out the infected portions and get rid of them. The tree's gotten bigger and with age, and this is true, the fire blight's less of an issue. Even though there's plenty of points of infection, the tree has a lovely growth habit. It really isn't killing it or blighting the bloom or the fruit production any particular amount. So I just don't worry about it at this point. But on a young tree, it can be quite devastating. Looking for fire blight resistance on crab apples and pears in general will be really good practice as you're out selecting. And there are some resistant varieties of crab apple.
So, if Emily is growing apples, one assumes, since she only gets 150 chilling hours, that she gets apple trees that are appropriate for her area. So, she's getting apples on them. So, I go back to my See if there are other people in your neighborhood who are also apple farmers and
Yes.
see what kind of crab apple they have. Now,
They have one.
crab apples like apples could be propagated from a cutting, couldn't they?
They're grafted.
So why wouldn't you just grow a crab apple on its own roots?
I don't know if you can. It's an interesting question. Someone asked me recently, why is this, that, or the other grafted? And usually it's nursery industry reasons that have not necessarily that something can't be rooted. It was about roses, they were asking. But on fruit trees, sometimes many fruit species won't root readily. So that would be one reason. So they just graft them. That's also more consistent. You just get a more consistent nursery product by grafting. That, I think, is the main reason, actually. And sometimes the rootstocks confer an advantage. Very commonly, the rootstock will have greater vigor, disease resistance, tolerance of wet soils. Apples have been planted in a lot of really rough soil areas historically. You may confer some greater cold hardiness. It may confer earlier fruit production. There's a lot of reasons rootstocks are used, but in not every case are they absolutely necessary. You could try rooting it from a cutting. You could even try growing a seed. And if that tree hasn't cross-pollinated, maybe the seedling of your crab apple would come true. It's a fairly slow way to get a crab apple, but it's certainly possible. Buying it may, the thing is, and I want to emphasize, is buying it may be challenging. I can tell you as a nursery guy, we sell one or two crab apples a year, maybe. It's not a popular tree in the Western arid states because apples are high water trees. They're just not as widely known here. They're just not part of our horticultural culture in California. They do grow here, but they're not drought tolerant particularly. But they can take lawn watering. That's a pretty short list right there of trees that can tolerate lawn watering. They can tolerate reasonably heavy soils that stay wetter than perhaps would be the preference of other types of fruit trees. So they have their place. But be aware that you're not going to stroll into the average nursery and find a bunch of crab apples to choose from. You may find only one or two varieties, and then it's just a matter of choosing for fall flower color, whether or not they fruit. Some are barely fruit, which is actually considered an advantage by people just growing them for ornamental purposes, and whether or not it's resistant to fire blight. And again, I'd come back to that as one of your deciding factors. If you're in a Southern California zone where you only have 100 or 200 chilling hours, you're probably only growing Beverly Hills apple or Anna, what I mentioned before, one of those that's a low chill apple to begin with, probably doesn't need a pollinizer. Most of those, to my knowledge, are self-fruitful, although that information would be on the tag when you buy it. And the crab apple would just be a nice bonus. I don't think you're going to find the information you're looking for because the main purveyor of crab apples in the Western states, J. Frank Schmidt Company, does not actually listed on their site, but you might send them a note and I'll bet you their customer relations folks would give you an answer. Simple question. What are your lowest chill crab apples? That's all you need to ask them. And probably one of the sales reps there will get back to you with a quick answer.
Plants with winter berries which might attract wildlife. Now let's define wildlife. Are you talking about turkeys, Don?
Sure. No, I'm not. There's a master gardener who contacted me doing an article for one of their publications and was curious about suggestions I had on this topic. And wildlife, generally, when we make these comments, we aren't mentioning that it includes tree squirrels, ground squirrels, possums, skunks, raccoons, turkeys, things like that. That's not what most people have in mind. Most people, in my opinion, have in mind songbirds. And, oh, squirrels maybe are kind of cute. Some people like tree squirrels, believe it or not. Some people feed tree squirrels. Don't feed tree squirrels. Okay. But plants with fruit will attract, in many cases, songbirds. Although I'm just speaking more as a naturalist than an expert on birds. My observation is a lot of the things that we say, oh, yes, attracts birds. It's usually because of the cover that the plant provides. It's not necessarily because of the fruit. It's, for example, Toyon is a really good example, and it's high up on my list here. We'll get to some of these others. I don't see little songbirds sitting on my Toyon eating the berries. I see the berries ripen and turn color, fall to the ground, and ground birds coming along and feeding on them, along with ground squirrels and possums and things like that. They're not sitting up there in the Toyon tree eating the berries, but they are sitting up there in the Toyon tree because as I walk by, they can rush back into the cover of the Toyon and feel protected. So some of these things that we're going to mention may or may not feed birds, or Lois might know better than I whether they feed birds, but they have berries and that attracts wildlife, broadly speaking. How's that?
It was pretty good, Don. It was pretty good. So, when Don says songbirds, I think he has in his mind the little tiny things rather than robins, which are songbirds,
Sure.
or mockingbirds, which are, I mean, songbird is passerine. That's a it's a style of bird physiology, and it's not, it doesn't have to be a little twittery thing to be a songbird.
True.
So, to answer your question that you didn't quite get to, but I'll answer it anyway.
We're getting there.
Toyon berries are wonderful, and they are highly prized by robins. Those robins and lots of other birds too, but they're big berries, and so a robin can get its beak around it, and that's a good thing. If you see the yellow-rumped warblers, which are common here in the wintertime, and the Toyon is blooming, it's ripening the berries, and there's a lot of little yellow-rumped warblers around. They're eating the insects rather than the fruit. The fruit is about as big as the head of the bird. It can't get its beak around it. Plus, its beak is not made for doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, a comment that I make when people ask about this is that berry size relates to bird size, and so you've got Toyon berries are pretty good size, and I've seen jays and mockingbirds in there having their fun in there, and jays and mockingbirds are great birds to bring into your garden. They're extremely important pest control. But yes, when I say songbird, I'm thinking finches and sparrows, I guess I'll put in that category, but
So,
not shrieking birds like corvids or anything in that category. Those aren't
and
songbirds. Those are scream birds.
if you listener are wanting to know what a bird eats, look at the beak, look at the bill. And if you see something that is big and chunky and maybe equilateral triangle shape,
There you go.
like the grosbeaks and that sort of thing, well, they are cracking nuts. Okay.
Oh, yes, they
If you
are.
see something that is a little thin thing, it's probably getting insects or little tiny seeds, but not big seeds and probably not seeds at all. If you see something that has the skinniest bill you've ever seen, and it's got like little hairs coming out beside the bill, those are insect eaters getting insects on the fly. Those are the
Flycatchers,
flycatcher type
swallows,
birds.
swallows. Yeah, okay.
And those hairs outside are to guide the bill so it knows when to grab. So it's fascinating structure. And then, of course, there's hummingbirds, and we don't need to say anything about
Yeah, we talk about them a lot.
them.
The
They've
main
got a
thing,
different kind of bill than everybody.
well, a lot of these plants that we, when I've given talks on drawing wildlife, I focus on cover and habitat rather than directly feeding them. Yes, there's many plants that feed animals and wildlife and birds directly, but the main thing that you need to provide, if you walk around my property and there's a lot of birds flying ahead of you as you walk, especially if you have dogs with you, the birds will flutter into the nearby bushes. That's what they're really after. If that happens to have fruit, I've watched these little songbirds on the Toyon because I have some very showy ones on my property, and they're in there and they're doing things, but they're not eating berries, but they're poking in around the berries, which means they're eating little
Insects.
bugs that are on the berries. So that will be the relevance of some of these plants we're going to mention. That was a long preamble, but the first question was, what about native plants that will feed wildlife? And the first one I thought of was the manzanita group, Arctostaphylos, which do have little berries that are certainly eaten by all kinds of things. The winter flowers of Arctostaphylos and its relatives are very attractive to hummingbirds as well. So that's a nice secondary bonus. There's not a lot of manzanitas that do well right here in the valley floor, but the one called Howard McMinn just seems to be very, very adaptable. And that's one that I do like to sell. The bigger ones tend to just be easy to unfortunately kill off because of our soil density and the fact that it retains moisture. But manzanitas are a good group. Toyon, we've certainly talked about that one. Big plant. When people plant Toyon, it's become our go-to big evergreen California native. Someone wants a hedge and they want it to be native. Well, in our area, that is your best choice because it's very doesn't seem to be susceptible to crown or root rot. It grows pretty fast. It's a nice big background plant. A couple pest problems you can get, but they typically aren't significant. And in just a few years, just 5 years, my Toyons were 10 to 12 feet tall and very dense and solid. So it's a very good native, doesn't happen to actually be native here on the Valley Floor, but close enough and adaptable enough that it's a very good choice in most parts of California, actually. Coffee berry, that's a big fruit. You look at the Toyon berry, this is half again bigger. So again, only certain animals going for that, but the plants are attractive. And again, the fruit is mostly eaten on the ground. And then I'll go ahead and throw in the one native ilex, Ilex vomitoria. So
Vomitoria, Don.
charming, charming name. Yes. Yeah. So that tells you something about us eating it, but I gather wildlife is okay with the yaupon, is the common name for Ilex vomitoria. Non-native plants do include Ilex, hollies, that's the whole group, and they don't have names like vomitoria, but I wouldn't personally eat the fruit. Hollies are really big back east. I mean, when we would travel to Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania, places like that, great big 100-year-old hollies that are trees. I mean, these are big plants, and they're quite beautiful back there. Not widely grown here, but they do grow here. Not super drought tolerant, but they're okay with just regular watering, and they can take watering cutbacks if they have to. Partial shade is best, and they're big plants. So, if you want berries or fruit on hollies without worrying about cross-pollination, which you do have to worry about if you want the common English hollies and others, you look for ones like Wilson's holly, 30-foot plant, big leaves, shiny, attractive leaves, large fruit, very attractive, tough, and adaptable. Ilex cornuta, the Chinese holly. Burfordi is the most commonly planted dwarf one because it can be kept at 4 to 6 feet with no problem. Big, shiny berries, easy to grow, doesn't require pollination. Or some of the hybrids like Nellie Stephen. So there are hollies that you can grow in California, get the berries on, and some of them get really big, some of them are smaller. Generally speaking, I would put them where they don't get the hottest sun of the day. Other than that, they're quite adaptable plants. And then the Arbutus group. Arbutus marina is the most popular these days. It's a big plant, 15, 20, 30 feet eventually, but very prunable. But Arbutus unido, the strawberry tree, yes, it will attract wildlife. It will also produce more fruit than you can possibly imagine. So I don't sell very much of that one because you'll have a carpet of fruit on the ground. And my observation is almost nothing eats it on the tree, but a lot of things eat it on the ground. So those are four-legged furry things that are eating it on the ground. Not sure how many of you want to encourage that, but they're very pretty and the berries are nice. And some of the birds will probably make some use of the fruit on the Arbutus unido. I'd go with marina personally.
Does Junito get eaten by your turkeys?
Yes, it does. I don't know
So
if
if you
that's
have
good or
turkeys
bad,
and
but
you want to encourage them,
yeah,
I don't
right.
know why you would, but so there's a possibility.
Yes, encouraging turkeys is surprisingly easy, let me tell you. The question that often comes up with the genus Arbutus, well, what about Madrone? That's our native Arbutus. Arbutus menziesi is our native Arbutus. The old saying is Madrone only grows where Madrone grows. I know that's a tautology, but what they're saying is that Madrone grows in its native range, and when you try and plant it out of its native range, it usually doesn't work. I do know an individual who is establishing Madrone in Village Homes, the native plant garden they have there. He did so by going and getting some soil from a place where Madrone grows, bringing some of that soil and putting it in where these are. I don't really recommend that.
Tricked it.
The
He tricked it.
Department of Agriculture would prefer that you not import soil in that manner because of the possibility of importing pathogens. But what he was importing was the important, he felt, soil mycorrhizae. And this is his area of expertise, so he knows what he's doing. Soil mycorrhizae that apparently are a big part of what makes Madrone successful where it grows. So far, so good. I'll keep you posted on the results of this experiment. But in general, Arbutus are really easy to grow, except for the native one. The native one, if you're lucky enough to live in Madrone country, by all means, plant a Madrone. All kinds of wildlife love Madrone and its related plants. It makes cover. I have a picture of a bird's nest in my Arbutus marina. The fruit is eaten by bigger birds and other things like the tree squirrels on my property. The flowers, which are on the plant all year round. Many of the Arbutus have blossoms at any time of year, very attractive to hummingbirds. And the heaviest bloom period, as with manzanitas, is winter. So you are giving something to the native hummingbirds. So those are some of the easy answers. But as I was walking around,
What?
go ahead.
You were talking about things that fruit in the winter. You didn't say anything about rose hips. I mean, they
So the
hang out in
next
berries.
next thing on my list is rose hips.
Sorry, Don.
As I was walking around taking pictures, to send for this article, because I promised to provide a few pictures, I saw two things that interested me that I wouldn't have thought of otherwise. Rose hips, for example, as Lois mentioned. Yeah. Now, this is definitely a case where you're not seeing little songbirds there picking a rose hip and flying back to their nest and eating the rose hip. They're tough. Rose hips have a tough skin, but you definitely see little birds on there. And they turn lovely color in the wintertime. I like to leave rose hips on. I know all the classic Rose Society folks checklist of things to do in your garden. Cut off the rose hips because you're taking energy away from bloom production. So what? Rose hips are very pretty. Some of them are very ornamental. Some of them are less attractive. Yes, if it's putting energy into hip production, it's not putting energy into flower production in December, not really a big issue. Some of them have really spectacular sprays of small rose hips, which I suppose a bird could pick and eat. But what I really see, once again, the little, what I call songbirds, hopping around in there, pecking at the rose hip, but not eating it. Maybe they're trying to get at the seed that's on the inside, but I'm guessing more likely there's little bugs on the outside. Roses pretty notoriously have bugs on them, and there's little things for them to feed on there. So I would urge you to leave your rose hips, at least from the last bloom that we always get here, which is October into early November. Almost all roses give a really nice fall bloom, and a lot of them set hips, and they will draw wildlife for various reasons. In particular, the shrub roses, the landscape roses, a lot of them where they weren't bred for giant flowers, will have sprays of small hips that are actually very attractive.
And if you happen to have a rose that has a large hip with lots of meaty flesh on it, people eat them too.
Yeah,
you make rose hip tea and that sort of thing.
Most
very high in vitamin C.
Most common for that are the Rosa rugosa, the rugosa hybrids, which are very hardy way into the north. I mean, this is what you'll see. It's like the only type of roses you'll see in some areas in the far north. And other species that are native there. And they tend to have hips that are used for tea. They have very, in many cases, very tangy flavor. And the hips are very, as I say, are very attractive. Side note, is it easy to grow roses from seed? Yes, it's surprisingly easy to grow roses from seed, and it can be fun. No telling what you're going to get. We do it every so often at our nursery. I'll bring in a hip from a rose that I happen to really like, and we'll just grow it out of curiosity. It takes about a year to get a bloom, and most of the plants you look at and go, huh, not worth keeping, and you'll throw it away. But that is where good new roses come from, by growing them from seed, from intentional hybridization. They do require stratification, has been our experience, which means we take the seeds out of those tough little hips and we refrigerate them for a few weeks before we plant them. But yes, you can grow roses from seed. I'm going to mention one that I also took a picture of because I hadn't even thought of it until I was out there looking at the fruit, which is Viburnum tinus. Viburnum tinus. It is one of the few viburnums that's widely sold in California. You go to botanical gardens, Morton Arboretum, Longwood Gardens, place that, you'll see these giant, big, leathery-leafed viburnums, which mostly kind of fry in our sun here in the Sacramento Valley. But Viburnum tinus likes full sun. In fact, it gets mildew if you put it in too much shade. It's a very elegant shrub with an upright oval growth habit. The most common on the market is Spring Bouquet, also sold as Compacta, which is easily kept at 5 to 6 feet, and so great for small yards. The flower buds start forming in the fall, open very slowly through the winter, and then are followed in the spring and summer by metallic blue berries that are still hanging on the plant. So I took some pictures of those that perhaps she will use for her article. Definitely see birds eating these, and they're little soft berries. They're little fruit. They look sort of like a privet berry, even smaller and somewhat more attractive. And the plant has reseeded a little bit on my property. Compared to the privet, not far away, which recedes like crazy, I don't think Viburnum tinus is ever going to become an invasive species here, but it's something to be aware of, that it can recede a bit, which, by the way, is an issue with some of the plants that we've always recommended for winter berries, like pyracanthus, gotoniasters. Some of them can become a little bit invasive. But this one, Viburnum tinus, has winter blooms. The buds are red, and they open to white flowers. Very pretty. Lasts for a couple months during the wintertime, and a relatively tight growth habit, so they don't even really need to be pruned in order to give an adequate small hedge. Viburnum tinus only has the common name Laurus tinus, which doesn't really help. So Viburnum tinus. Tinus. So that's an unusual one that I only occurred to me because I was walking around taking pictures. Yeah, I've got pyracantha. It's got issues, gets fire blight. This thorns, pyracantha literally means fire thorn. If you've ever pruned them, you agree. The thorns are not only formidable, but also painful because they have an irritant in them. It does recede, and we're concerned that pyracantha could hypothetically become invasive. Cotoneasters, which look like pyracanthas but without the thorns, some have become invasive in places where they're widely planted. Fruit that attracts birds will probably be disseminated by birds. So if it's something that attracts them to feed on it, we want to make sure it's not something that's invasive. I mean, I could mention privets, for example.
Oh,
Privets
please don't, Don. No,
definitely,
please
well, I'll
don't.
mention them as part of the caveat. They definitely attract birds, which scatter them all over the place. Palm trees, the Phoenix canariensis that my neighbor half a mile around the corner has. Oh, yeah, birds love the fruit of Canary Island date palms when they ripen. And that's why I have about eight on my property that I'm trying to get out. So there are plants that can become invasive because the fruit is disseminated by birds or other forms of wildlife. Try to be aware of that as you're choosing these. There's one here that's kind of in between. There are a lot of plants that have seeds instead of berries, and seeds attract songbirds. I'll go out on a limb and suggest that they're probably songbirds in most cases. When I leave my celosia, my amaranth, my sunflowers, just let them die out in the vegetable garden. I do that because I'll go out there on a day like today when it's sunny in late October, early November. Lots of little birds on there taking advantage of the seed that will then be all over the place next year, but they're enjoying the seed. The one plant that I have that's more of a tree, large shrub or tree that's in that category is Vitex agnus castus, the chaste tree. Vitex is a beautiful large shrub, heavily suckers from the base, so it's really a large shrub or multi-trunk tree if you work at it. It doesn't have berries, it has clusters of seeds that follow the blossom spikes, but the seeds are very attractive to small birds, and they also like the cover that it provides. It is deciduous, but it's very late to drop its leaves. I'd find it's not bare until almost January. And anytime you walk by the two or three that are on my property, you'll see little songbirds on them. Great plant for hot, sunny areas, also tolerant of watering or drought. I see them around old farmhouses now and then. And the blooms are at the same season as crepe myrtles, but blue. Blue flowers in the garden are rare, and it has a long bloom season, very easy plant to grow, and definitely makes great cover for birds. And I think the seeds are a food source as well.
So, Don, I was going to ask, what are you harvesting today? But I suddenly realized it's Halloween. Of course, there are pumpkins out there.
I'm harvesting pumpkins as we speak. Actually, I did really well this year with seed pumpkins for pepitas. I was growing them because one of my staff people likes to roast pumpkin seeds. If you like to do this, they're easy to grow. Yes, they take as much room as regular pumpkins. They run all over the place, but they're generally smaller fruited. And there's one called Baby Bear, and there's another one called Godiva, as in Lady Godiva, and another one called Kakai, Kakai, I think is the name of that one, grown specially for their hullless. Hard word to say, hullless or semi-hullless seeds without hulls.
Naked, call them naked,
Naked
Don.
seeds, they're hullless. They don't have that extra coating over them that makes other pumpkin seeds chewy. These are tender. They're mostly seed. They've been bred and selected to where you cut open this little 6-inch pumpkin and there's 100 seeds inside there. And they come out readily and they rinse and you salt them and roast them and they're quite delicious. So I did very well with those and I've been harvesting them over the month. There's still a few of them out there. Baby Bear, Godiva, Kakai is a really pretty one that has extremely attractive and large hullless seeds. That's a really good one. So if you've got room for pumpkins, these are fun to grow. And it's really easy to process. I mean, just scoop them out and rinse all that stuff off, dry them, and then roast them. So very easy and fun for people who have room for pumpkin vines. That's one thing we're harvesting now, plus pecans. Pumpkins are easy to grow if you have room for it. I will tell you, I grow them every year. They take lots of water. These are deep-rooted plants, and they're extremely vigorous vines. Each vine can grow 25 to 30 feet in all directions if it's allowed to. So it's a rural garden opportunity. In your yard, if you put it in your vegetable garden, I'll suggest plant it on the edge of the vegetable garden, let it run out of the bed and along the shrubs and around the bed and up onto the shrubs and trees if necessary. That's absolutely fine. And pumpkins are actually surprisingly easy to grow if you keep them growing. I know that sounds weird, but if a pumpkin loses its growing point, and for whatever reason, drought or someone breaks it off, that's it. It's you need all the new leaves to support those rapidly expanding, very large fruit that are way back on the vine. And if you lose that, if it doesn't keep growing, whatever has set will probably stop developing and will just ripen that size. So if you're trying to grow really big pumpkins, they have to keep growing. They have to get considerable territory of new leaves continuously coming on through the growing season to sustain the 20, 50, 100, 300, 2,500 pound pumpkin that you're growing back further on the vine. But smaller fruited ones are pretty easy to grow. And so I always plant pie pumpkins, the one that's called sugar or pie, the classic heirloom pie pumpkin, very easy to grow. You'll get five or six fruit on a single hill of those, and that's enough for most people. I always grow some of the seed pumpkins, like these pepitas, it's what you'll usually find listed in the seed catalog. And I do some bigger ones just for fun. But I think if you are trying to make better use of your vegetable garden, you'll find the pie pumpkins and the pepitas are worth the space and actually fun to grow.
You know, we should do a show about odd flowers. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, my mother, that was one of her hobbies that I inherited, growing flowers just to see what they look like. I didn't know most people don't do that.
Odd flowers. You know, passiflora comes to mind.
Oh, she had a whole fence of passiflora. And to give quick cover on a patio fence, she alternated Passiflora, Alato ceruleus, and Japanese honeysuckle on alternate panels of fence, Lonicera japonica, Hollyana. Both of those are bad choices in coastal San Diego for their extraordinary invasive character. Both of them very, very hard to get rid of. And 20, 30 years later, removing them was a major undertaking. But she did tell a story where she had the passion flower blooming on the patio, and it was out where you could see it from the street. And she looked out and she realized there were two Nobel Prize winners standing on her front porch. Roger Revelle was escorting Harold Urey and another Nobel Prize winner around the neighborhood. And they were looking at her passifloras. And she came out 30, 25, 30 years old to see these extraordinary luminaries of the science world looking at her flowers and was delighted and stunned to learn they didn't know what it was. So they asked her, "What is this flower?" She said, "That's Passiflora." And she told this story for years that she was informing a Nobel recipient in the field of physics what the plant was on her patio. Passiflora, she had an affection for that plant for many years after that, just because of that story. So she planted things because they were quick and easy. That's why the backyard was full of cannas and flag irises and crinum lilies and things that she just got as cast-offs. And much of the landscaping initially was done just with the kind of free over-the-fence plants that neighbors give to neighbors. The stand of crinums was 10 by 10. I inherited that yard, kind of took over it when I was a teenager, and they were spectacular. They also breed snails like crazy, just if you happen to ever decide to grow crinums on the coast. But these are the kind of plants that you don't buy at a nursery. Those types of things, you just share them with friends. And that was how they landscaped their yard initially. Then eventually, when income got better, they actually bought plants to put in. But you start with what I call the over-the-fence plants from your neighbors. Some of your best plants are free.
Yes.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.